This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening, and thank you for tuning in to Eco Radio. On tonight's program, Frank Smith and Joe Spees discuss fracking with host Craig Lubo. But first, I'm naturally with your headline news. GlobeandMail.com reports, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is poised to sign on to a centennial environment and climate change strategy with outgoing President Barack Obama when the two leaders hold their first formal bilateral meeting in the Oval Office next Thursday. International Trade Minister Chrystia Freeland, who chairs the Cabinet Committee on Canada-U.S. Relations, told the Globe and Mail that the White House talks will also result in improved border security measures and steps to conclude a new softwood lumber agreement. This is a catch-all ASF view. Canadian and U.S. officials are now working hard behind the scenes to present an environmental and climate change package for the leaders to announce, but the exact details of what it entails are being kept closely under wraps. But sources say the agreement is expected to deal with tighter fuel and auto emission standards and measures to foster innovation such as electric cars, charging stations, self-driving vehicles, and ride-sharing apps. National Snow and Ice Data Center.org report, January Arctic sea ice extent was the lowest in the satellite record, attended by unusually high air temperatures over the Arctic Ocean and a strong negative phase of the Arctic Oscillation for the first 3 weeks of the month. Meanwhile, in the Antarctic, this year's extent was lower than average for January, in contrast to the record high extents in January 2015. Arctic sea ice extent during January averaged 13.53 million square kilometers, which is 1.04 million square kilometers below the 1981 to 2010 average. This was the lowest January extent in the satellite record, 90,000 square kilometers below the previous January low that occurred in 2011. The WashingtonPost.com reports, the temperature of the lowest section of the atmosphere hit its highest level on record in February, as estimated by weather satellites. The planet was 0.83 degrees Celsius warmer than the long-term average, according to Roy Spencer, research scientist at the University of Alabama at Huntsville, who worked with John Christie to develop the original analysis of satellite-derived global temperatures. The February reading is remarkable in that it rose almost 0.3 degrees from the warmest level in January on record established last month. Incredibly, land areas outside the tropics in the northern hemisphere were a whopping 1.46 degrees Celsius above average, 0.5 degrees above any previous month in Alamy, Spencer said. The record-setting February reading represents an inconvenient data point for those that claim the Earth isn't warming. Friends of the Earth International.org report, Berta Cáceres, 2015 Goldman Environmental Prize winner, was murdered March 2nd in her home. Reportedly, her assassins waited until well after dark before breaking into the house where she slept. It is not yet known who is behind Cáceres' assassination, but as an indigenous environmental and human rights activist, she knew well the risks she faced. In 1993, she co-founded the National Council of Popular and Indigenous Organizations of Honduras to address the growing threats posed to indigenous communities by illegal logging, fight for their territorial rights, and improve their livelihoods. The work of COPINH is still sorely needed. Honduras has been called, quote, the deadliest place for environmental activists, end quote, and is a country where corruption is a major problem. 12 activists were killed last year alone for their efforts to defend land and the global and the environment, according to a report by UK-based NGO Global Witness, more per capita than any other country, a record Honduras has held for the last 5 years. EcoWatch.com reports, consumer advocate Aaron Brockovich and the law firm Whites and Luxembourg announced on March 4th that they are expanding their investigation to perfluorooctanoic acid water contamination to include North Bennington, Vermont. Perfluorooctanoic acid, or PFOA, was used for decades by DuPont and other companies to make nonstick, waterproof, and stain-resistant products. The announcement comes after new tests by the state of Vermont revealed several wells in the town contained the same chemical that was found in the Hoosick Falls, New York, and Petersburg, New York water system. quote, "We are facing a water contamination crisis across our country. North Bennington is the latest in a long line of communities who can no longer trust the most basic necessity of life. I hope this investigation will help residents understand more about the size and scale of the problem," end quote, Brockovich said. The Vermont Department of Environmental Conservation announced it found elevated levels of PFOA in North Bennington within a mile and a half of the former Chemfab factory after testing several wells in the area. Before we turn it over to Craig and his guest, we'll hear from Mike Murphy about yesterday's PeaceWorks annual meeting.
Thank you very much, naturally. Yes, yesterday was indeed PeaceWorks annual meeting held at the Simpson House here in Kansas City. And we were there on hand to record a lot of the proceedings. We're just going to play a little bit of some of what we heard. We're going to hear from Ann Sullentrop, who's no stranger to this program, and is on the Action Committee of PeaceWorks. Ann's been on this program talking about the cleanup of the old weapons plant on Bannister Road, the concerns about the new weapons plant. And so here she does a nice job of giving a synopsis of all that PeaceWorks does with regard to the weapons plant here in town, as well as things they do on a national level. So from yesterday afternoon, here's Ann Sullentrop.
I'm going to just go like for 4 minutes. So I timed it at home. It's not very long. And I'm going to talk about international, national, and local, and then Ron's going to go down to the nitty-gritty. So, it's my opinion that nuclear weapons are a symptom of our fear and our lack of mercy towards others. In a matter of minutes, the entire world as we know it could be destroyed. For example, just one Trident submarine can launch hundreds of missiles and destroy all major cities in countries. But modern supercomputers have proven that these are suicidal weapons, as they will loft enormous plumes of soot and debris into the stratosphere, blocking the sun and causing a new ice age, destroying crops for years to come. So as a result of this new proven information, it's called the humanitarian impact. These are the reason why the vast majority of countries who do not have nukes are moving in the United Nations to draft a treaty banning them. And there's a group called the Open-Ended Working Group, the OEWG, and they will meet in Geneva, Switzerland in May to start drafting, actually putting together this treaty. And this is whether the few, I think there's eight something, nuclear weapons states agree with it or not. And so far they haven't participated in it. This will start the process of outlawing nukes and eventually getting rid of them. The non-nuclear weapons states are saying they have a right to survive, and that trumps our right to so-called security. The other international thing that's going on that I didn't write in here, but the Marshall Islands were nuked by the United States repeatedly during the 40s and 50s, and their islands are uninhabitable. They're suing the nuclear weapons states in the international court. And other parts of the world were equally affected, like the British bombed the Aboriginal lands in Australia, and they're contaminated to this day. Russians bombed in Kazakhstan. They have lots of children and that are born with birth defects and so forth. So it's contaminated our whole world. So nationally, the proposed 2017 U.S. budget has just come out. And the powers that be are starting, guess what, a new Cold War. They're planning to spend $1 trillion over the next 30 years to remake and redo all nuclear weapons. And they want to have all new nuclear bomb factories and facilities. And of course, we know here in Kansas City, we were the first one to get a new nuclear bomb plant, and the first one built in the U.S. in over 30 years. And we were a part of protesting to that. New facilities are being proposed for the uranium secondaries, they call them, at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and for plutonium primaries, or they call them pits, at the Los Alamos lab in New Mexico. The Bannister Federal Complex got more attention in this 2017 budget, and I have a copy right here. If anybody wants to look at it, I've highlighted the parts pertaining to the Kansas City plant. And the Kansas City plant is one of the National Nuclear Security Administration's 10 high-risk facilities. And so it's going to be transferred to a private company to clean up. The federal government made the big contaminated mess there, but they're going to let a private company clean it up. And so the budget lists an additional $200 million for Kansas City's recapitalization, and that means shutting it down and maintaining continued surveillance on the massive contamination left there. The excellent recent investigation by the McClatchy Group, published in the Kansas City Star, and I posted it on our display boards in there, lists almost 2,500 hazardous toxins used at the plant, and this includes radioactive substances. And when we first started protesting at the plant, they would only allow that there was maybe a few hundred toxins there, but they have uncovered more. So in 2 months, Peaceworks board member Jordan Sunny Hamrick and myself will go to Washington, D.C. to lobby about this budget. And this is the annual Alliance for Nuclear Accountability's D.C. Days. And I invite anyone interested to join us. You will get first class training in lobbying, and you'll meet anti-nuclear activists who've been active in this for decades. It's awesome. But then, down to the local level, what can we do to bring about world peace and real security? The way I see it, as we come together today, celebrating our various local efforts for peace, we are exercising our peace muscle, the opposite of fear and hatred. In each of our everyday lives, as we show love and tender concern for those around us and for those who live far off, in a very real way, we ourselves are strengthening efforts for peace. And this is even things that we do to create peace within ourselves. That counts as well. Gandhi said, change is made with 80% building up and 20% tearing down. So I say, build up peace muscles, not peacekeeper missiles. How about it? Peace muscles, yes. Not peace missiles.
Peace muscles.
Peace muscles, not peace missiles. Peace muscles, not peace missiles.
And that was Ann Sullentrop at Peaceworks annual meeting yesterday afternoon. And for the record, Ann, that was a little bit more than 4 minutes. But now I'm going to turn it over to Craig. There you go, Craig.
All right. Thank you, Mike. And we do have two guests tonight. I have Joe Spies. He is with the Sierra Club. Over on the Kansas side, he chairs the Energy and the Legislative and Fracking Committees. And on the phone, we have Frank Smith, who is a community organizer since 1966, on a variety of issues, including fracking, which is tonight's topic. Welcome, Frank and Joe.
Thank you.
Yeah, how are you doing, Craig?
All right. And let me start with Joe. Just kind of a brief description for those who are not familiar with what fracking is. Give a couple minutes describing what the process is.
Sure. With fracking, oil and gas companies, and they do seek different things. There are companies going after oil. There are some geologic formations that are oil only and not as productive with gas, and then there are others that are more productive with gas and less so with oil. But it's a technology that's been around for several decades, but it's only since about 2005, after the government passed legislation, the federal government passed the Energy Policy Act of 2005 that created the exemptions for the oil and gas industry from problems related to clean air the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act, and RCRA, the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, which is the Superfund law. That's when the horizontal drilling took off that's been the cause of so many problems. With fracking, you drill down about a mile or so, and then when you hit the geologic seam, geologic formation that contains the oil or gas that they seek, then they go horizontally for a mile or two. Then they explode the formation. They inject a lot of water, anywhere from 3 to 8 million gallons per fracking attempt, that's laced with a lot of toxic chemicals and some sand that will hopefully release the oil or gas they seek, that will flow back to the surface, and they capture it there, and then they have to get rid of that toxic fracking waste fluid, which when it comes back up is also usually radioactive. And that's of course been the source of the fracking earthquakes, or the frack quakes, that are causing so many problems in Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, and in other states. But that's fracking in a nutshell.
Okay. And when you say horizontal, was that always the preferred method, or are there other methods of fracking that they used before that were safer?
Now, the vertical fracking has been around for many decades, where, for example, in the Hugoton Field in western Kansas, it wasn't just western Kansas. The Hugoton Field covers parts of five states, but when the Hugoton Field declined, they had to come up with a way of extracting more gas out of that field. And so they started drilling down and then blasting the rock apart, and that would release some more gas. And that wasn't as much of a problem because you don't use as many fluids in that process. But then they started experimenting with this technique, horizontal drilling, and over the course, it was started in the 80s and 90s when they were working on the technology needed to make it work. And then, of course, once they oil prices started increasing, and because fracking, especially horizontal drilling, costs 10 times more than conventional drilling for oil and gas. So it's a very expensive process, and prices for oil and gas have to be at a certain point for the oil and gas companies to profit. But when the prices hit a certain price point, they got exemptions from the environmental regulations after 2005. Then that horizontal drilling technology, which the oil and gas industry perfected, took off, and fracking and all the problems that come with it also took off.
All right. And tell me, what are some of the problems?
There's so many. First is the threat of water contamination. The problem in fracking is with the casings. When they drill down that mile or so and then go horizontally, they insert a pipe, and they have to secure that pipe to the rock wall with cement. That's called a casing. And what we're seeing, and this comes from studies from the petroleum industry itself and many reputable petroleum engineers, that cement fails. And studies done by professors at Cornell, Anthony and Graffia and Arthur Berman and others, have proved that as many as 5 to 10% of those casings will fail within the first year, and then it only increases after that. And it's through those failed casings that you have fugitive methane that gets into the air and into water, and the toxic chemicals also now have a pathway into water supplies. That is extremely dangerous. Then you have the fugitive methane that escapes. Methane is 80 times worse than carbon dioxide at trapping heat and causing climate change. And there is far more methane leaking now than we have ever understood. Just in January of this year, scientists with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration released a study and satellite photos showing that the largest methane cloud on the planet is hovering over Oklahoma, Kansas, and Texas, where we see a lot of hydraulic fracturing. This is extremely dangerous at a time when climate change is causing trillions of dollars annually in economic damage, and all this fugitive methane is escaping and exacerbating the problem of climate change. Then you have the problem of water supply, where with fracking, if you're using 3 to 8 million gallons per fracking attempt, and as many as 16 attempts are possible per well pad, and you have tens of thousands of well pads around this country, you're talking about the need for hundreds of billions and close to trillions of gallons of fresh water that, once contaminated with the toxic chemicals and the radioactive elements that come from the geologic formation, is untreatable. The only thing that can be done with that fresh water is to dispose it into these deep injection wells. That is water that is gone forever from the hydrologic cycle. And at a time when scientists and computer modeling have shown that climate change is going to reduce our access to fresh water supplies, to take that amount of fresh water out of the hydrologic cycle is really stupid. We have to really make sure we understand that without fresh water, we have no economy and no life. So we need to be a little bit more careful with that. And there are other problems. I could go on and on about the problems with fracking, but those are some of the major problems. We have the earthquakes, which I know we're going to be talking about when the fracking wastewater is disposed into these injection wells, and those injection wells are located near geologic faults with the potential for quakes. You're just greasing the skids. That water is injected down there under pressure, and it causes slippage in those geologic formations. And these frack quakes are causing hundreds of millions of dollars of damage. They're ruining people's lives. The one quake in Oklahoma, in Prague, Oklahoma, destroyed over a dozen homes. I mean, reduced them to rubble. But it doesn't have to be that drastic to really cause serious damage. If you're looking at the damage to foundations and walls and driveways and other property, that can add up to tens of thousands of dollars, and insurance companies aren't going to pay for it because they claim that it's the responsibility of the oil and gas companies, and the oil and gas companies won't pay for it because they're saying you can't point to one specific injection of that fluid that is responsible for that earthquake. So the homeowners and the businesses and down in Harper, near where Frank Smith used to live, their courthouse had $1.1 million in damage from these frack quakes. And so it's public buildings, and that gets passed on to the taxpayer. So there are a lot of problems, and they're all very, very serious.
And I think some of the quakes have apparently been felt as far north as Kansas City.
The ones that took happened in January, we had just in rapid succession, a 4.8 and a 4.1. Those earthquakes that were centered right on the Kansas-Oklahoma border were felt in seven states. So the effects are being felt quite a distance from here.
And so additionally, would it be a threat or a danger from those quakes to potentially some of the nuclear power plants in the area, as well as where they keep nuclear missiles?
Yeah, especially if you're looking at Texas and in Kansas, the potential threat to everyone from these nuclear power plants is extremely serious. There is a fault called the Cambridge Fault that rides underneath the Wolf Creek nuclear plant that's not too far from Emporia, Kansas, which is right in that range where the quakes are felt without a question. And the risk occurs with how the radioactive waste is stored. In most cases, that radioactive waste is in these concrete cylinders that are stacked one on top of another. A quake at that facility could very easily cause those cylinders to topple, crack, and release a radioactive cloud. And if you look at where the prevailing winds in Kansas come from, which are from the south, that could blow a radioactive cloud right into some of the most populous areas of Kansas, in Topeka, Lawrence, and Kansas City. This is not something to trifle with. We can't risk this. They face a similar problem in Texas, where they have a serious earthquake problem, and there is a nuclear power facility just 60 miles south of Dallas, where the same situation, their prevailing winds are coming from the south, and one accident there could lead to a catastrophe like we've never seen.
Frank, let me ask you, you used to live in Kansas, and I think you also had some personal experiences, experienced the earthquakes from the fracking. Tell us some about that, please.
Yeah, well, toward the end of 2013, I think it was around October, my wife and I were sitting in the house. We're both retired. And I heard a really loud bang. And I was concerned because there was a well drilled just about a mile north of our house. And I was afraid the well blew up. I actually ran to a window where I could observe that well, and it had not blown up, but it was just one hell of a noise. So we called the USGS, which has reports on these quakes just minutes after they occur, and we asked about the quake, and they said, "Well, what's your address?" And we gave them the address and said, "Where's the epicenter?" And they said, "It's under your house." The quake was originally thought to be 4.1 quake, which is a pretty strong quake. It was eventually downgraded to a 3.9, and they figured the epicenter was actually about a mile north of the house, right alongside the fracking line that that went out from that well. Well, I had had problems before that. They'd torn up the roads really badly, and people don't usually talk about this, but they do a great deal of damage to infrastructure, not only through the earthquakes, like that destroyed the east end of our county courthouse in Harper County, but also to the roads and bridges. You've got a culture of recklessness, I think, that permeates the fracking industry. They're all competing with each other. Things have gotten much worse in the last year because the price of oil has plummeted to, I don't know, about $25 a barrel right now. Back in 2008, the price of oil was $144 a barrel. So it's they're really scrambling to stay afloat. And some of these corporations like Chesapeake and Sandridge that were the dominant operators in Harper County are very close to bankruptcy, I think. So they're scrambling, and they operate with recklessness. You know, they killed our dogs. We had two dogs, and then we replaced them with one after they disappeared, and that one was killed at the end of our driveway by a vibrator that was it was Baker Hughes, which is a subcontractor to Sandridge. We had lots of problems with the destroyed bridges and torn up roads, and besides the earthquakes themselves. Of course, the earthquakes, well, we lived in a very old house. It was begun construction in 1888, and we had foundation problems, and we had problems with the walls and ceilings with cracks that were growing ever longer and larger. And it was very distressing. And I should say that my wife and I are pretty calm people. But the psychological pressures that have visited on people that are seeing their houses sometimes crumbling in front of them, like Joe mentioned in Prague, Oklahoma, it's a real pressure. It's a real threat. People correctly observe it as a threat to their net worth. If the value of the house is decreasing because of the damage that the quakes are doing to them. So I fought, and I actually got compensated for damage done to my car, and then for damages. Well, the last dog that was killed, I insisted that they settle with a payment to a nonprofit, a peace center in Wichita, Kansas, and then I finally got so disgusted with it. We were having up to 8 earthquakes a day, believe it or not. We're right 7 miles north of the Oklahoma border, so there's very heavy fracking going on in our county, Harper, and the county just to the east of that, Sumner County, and then south of us in Grant and Alfalfa counties in particular. That's in the area of Cherokee and Alva, Oklahoma, and Medford, Oklahoma. There's a tremendous amount of fracking injection wells there, and these injection wells were precipitating an enormous amount of quakes, some of them with epicenters within 15 or 20 miles of our house that ranged from 4.2 to 4.9. It's a pretty strong quake. Not as much as it could be. Like the Prague quake was, Joe can help me out here, but I think it was estimated about 5.6 if it was that high.
Yeah, I think it was 5.7, but that's just close.
Yes, but I think actually they that's not it's not a hard science. They often will disagree on the magnitude of these quakes, but they're substantial quakes. And they do a lot of damage. And as Joe has mentioned, I think he's done a splendid job talking to your audience today about the many, many quakes that we've had. I should mention a few things. Years ago, I was fighting private prisons in Kansas, and I've stopped them all over the country. I started in Alaska 20 years ago. And I had a local legislator from eastern Kansas asked me why I was so opposed to private prisons, and I spent about a half an hour trying to explain it to him, and he just didn't get it. He wasn't the brightest light on the street. And finally I said, well, think about this. Think about what it does to the environment and to the residents. How would you like it if you had, say, a nuclear power plant with waste in your neighborhood? And he said, well, we do. He was the representative, it turned out, for the Wolf Creek plant. And he just did not understand the problems. I want to say a couple of things because this has come out in the last couple of days. Bernie and Hillary last night in Michigan had a debate, and the subject of fracking was brought up. And Hillary was asked what she thought about fracking. She said, well, essentially, it had to be done a lot more safely, which is Sarah Palin's recommendation for things like the blowout in the deep water horizon blowout in the Gulf of Mexico that did immense ecological damage. And Hillary's position is much the same. It was, well, we've got to do it more carefully. We can't let all this leakage of methane, and we've got to watch out for earthquakes, and, you know, we've got to disclose what's in the fracking fluids. And Bernie had a better answer. He said, I'm completely opposed to fracking, period. That was it. And I thought that was a good answer because of this pervasive recklessness. I don't think we can depend on the industry to ever conduct itself in a professional manner where it would not endanger the public. In all the venues that Joe's talked about, the atmosphere, the surface, earthquakes, the pollution of surface water. Ironically, just a few minutes ago, I do Open Records Act requests a lot, and I've stopped many private prisons by unearthing government documents. And I just got word back a few minutes before our phone call that I have they're going to honor my my request for documents about the damage done to an elderly gentleman's house that lives near Anthony, Kansas. It destroyed two wells. It destroyed his stock ponds, which he used to feed wildlife. It damaged his shop very badly, and his house was leaking. The roof was leaking, and the windows were leaking. Water. It was, and he had very, very little retirement income. So this was a tremendous burden to this guy. He had to actually hook up to county water, which, ironically, the county admitted. Is not safe for pregnant women and young children to drink, but that was his option to get away from water that was so saline you could practically walk on it. It was like the Dead Sea. It was 475 parts per million, and maybe Joe has a better grasp on what exactly that means. But it's far beyond the standard for drinking water. It would taste like seawater, I think.
Frank, we do need to take a quick break. And for those just joining us, we're talking about fracking today with Frank Smith and Joe Spies, and we'll be back in a moment.
Should the media be taking white supremacy more seriously? Counterspin, Tuesday evening at 6:30.
On the next Radioactive magazine, Jeff Clements, author of Corporations Are Not People, and president of American Promise, an anti-Citizens Review advocacy group, will discuss the impact of big money on the integrity of our electoral process and what we as American citizens can do about it. That's Radioactive magazine, Tuesday at 6 p.m.
It all comes out in the wash on this current cast.
it's really important that you think about how water quality will be impacted by what you use in your daily life.
That's Aislinn Gauthier of the John G. Shedd Aquarium in Chicago. She says when personal care products, harsh cleaning chemicals, or pesticides end up in the watershed, they can harm creatures that rely on good water quality to survive.
Those really delicate animals, like amphibians that breathe through their skin and are so connected to the water, are so susceptible to things like that.
So Gauthier suggests if you would not consume a product yourself, consider if and how you use it carefully. There are often less harmful alternatives so you can have a clean house and clean conscience. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
On March 2nd, longtime advocate for the homeless and founder of Care of Poor People, Richard Tripp, passed away. KKFI assured his family that we would let listeners know of funeral arrangements. Services will be held at Grand Avenue Temple, 205 East 9th Street, on March 12th at 10 a.m. This message, a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
This week, destruction of sites, which we call cultural cleansing, is a precursor for ethnic cleansing.
We map out the destruction of ancient religious sites in the Middle East, and we hear how looting is generating revenue for extremists. I'm Maureen Fiedler. That's next time on Interfaith Voices.
Tuesday at noon, right before The Jazz Disciple.
Okay, this is Craig Lubo, and we're back with Joe Spies and Frank Smith. We're talking about fracking. Joe, one of the things you mentioned before, and you referred to price point, and we were talking about the, Frank, you both mentioned about the drop in the oil prices. Is it conceivable that the fracking industry will, because of economics, perhaps, I don't know if it would completely shut down, but diminish greatly because it's not going to be profitable for them to operate anymore?
No, because all it's going to take is for the price of oil to increase, and we're already seeing that now. What just happened at an OPEC meeting was an agreement between some of the largest oil producers in the Middle East, the Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, and a few others, to push back production a little bit, to reduce the supply and hopefully drive up prices. While there's not a doubt in my mind that OPEC was out to punish the frackers in the United States who were stealing some of their market that they believe should have been theirs. And I think that they really were trying to drive some of the American companies out of business, and they were successful. As Frank said, Sandridge and Chesapeake are both in desperate trouble. They are going to be filing bankruptcy, and they have other problems, legal problems that are happening right now, too. But you're just going to see the deck shuffled. There are companies like GE and their turbine business who are scared to death that if fracking is hurt, GE's business is going to be hurt. And GE just announced today that they are going out to hire a lot of the people from companies like Chesapeake and Sandridge who are losing their jobs just to keep them involved in the oil industry because they're convinced that the price is going to go back up. And the same companies might change names, but the areas where fracking is being done now will increase as the price of oil increases.
All right. And the other issue in terms of that would be in the environmental regulation. If we reimposed, you said, I think it was in 2005, with the energy plan that Congress passed, and they granted all these exemptions to the fracking industry. So if those were reimposed, what economic effect would that have on the companies, and what effect would that have on the level of fracking that they would be doing?
It would bring things to a screeching halt because they would then be liable for the damages that they're causing. And since we know now how better to regulate and monitor what they're doing. For example, with water contamination, part of the legal excuse that the oil and gas companies have used to avoid liability for the contamination of the thousands of water sources they've contaminated around the country is that people didn't do testing of their water supplies before the oil and gas companies started their fracking. Since that water wasn't tested beforehand, it was impossible to say for certain when and how the different water sources, water wells, got contaminated. So it was a legal problem related to the timing of the testing being done. With those environmental regulations back in place, it would really be the death of those oil and gas companies, because knowing that they're going to be responsible for billions and billions of dollars of suits and actions that would be successful in court is going to put them out of business.
Is there any litigation that has been pursued or is pending that would perhaps overturn that legislation and impose some liability?
No, the right-wingers in Congress won't even entertain anything right now. And since they control the committees and they determine which bills are introduced, there have been attempts. Senator Wyden from Oregon has attempted a couple of times. Some Democratic representatives in the states that have been hit hardest, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and others have attempted it, but they can't even get a bill introduced. What has been more successful, at least in slowing things down, has happened at the community level, where communities in Colorado and others have banned fracking. Now, in Texas, this is a really sore point. Any person who appreciates the freedoms we have in this country should be outraged at what happened in Denton, Texas, where there was a referendum on a ballot, and the people in Denton voted to ban fracking in their community. The state legislature, in response to that, knowing that we should all know that a lot of state legislatures are dominated by the oil and gas industry, their campaign contributions, they control who's doing what, and especially on energy-related committees. The Texas state legislature voted to pass a bill that then prevented communities from banning fracking. And so while it didn't work in Texas, there are other communities in Colorado and other states where their efforts to ban it have been more successful. New York has been successful in holding it off, and in other communities where there have been real water problems, they've been successful in slowing things down too.
All right, and I've been told we do have a caller that has called in with a question. Caller, would you state your first name and where you're calling from?
David, West Plaza. And a basic fact of chemistry is that acids lower surface tension, and that fluid that they put back in the ground, besides having heavy metals, radioactive isotopes in it now, it also is acidic in nature. So when they start ejecting it back down in the ground to get rid of it, it's actually lubricating, it's an acid. So it's lowering surface tension between those plates and rock formations, and that even aids to the movement that they're experiencing now. So I heard a geologist talk about that one thing. That was part of it. It's not, it is acidic. So, yeah, that's a big problem with the fluid, besides just being evil. Okay, thanks.
All right, thanks for calling. Joe, when I asked that question, I want to clarify on the environmental regulation, the legal issues. I was thinking more in terms of if there's been any attempt to get the court system to rule parts of that new legislation, I guess, unconstitutional, and say that they can't prevent them from exempting the fracking industry.
Well, with the Energy Policy Act of 2005, that's law that exempted the oil and gas companies and gave them an out. If they're not going to be held accountable for the damage they're doing, and that is still solid there, and that's in place, there really isn't much of anything that can be done. So we either have to reverse that Energy Policy Act of 2005 or watch and see if communities can be successful at banning it, and that has been a mixed bag of success and failure.
Right. I would like to say my response, let's see, it's been about a year and a half ago, after having all these problems with the frackers, I finally filed protests against two new injection wells that were proposed for Harper County, for southern Harper County, south of Anthony, just north of Manchester, Oklahoma. And it was a long, arduous process with pre-hearing conferences and things like that. And it cost me a lot of time, unfortunately, and a huge amount of money. But I brought a case to Kansas Corporation Commission. This is very similar to court proceedings. The litigation is very similar. And I handle it pro se because I don't have very much money. But I do know my way around courtrooms. And I made a case that these well permits that were being requested shouldn't be granted at the levels they were requesting, at least. And I also made a case to the Kansas Corporation Commission, which, ironically, the members of which were appointed by Sam Brownback, who is not a friend to consumers and residents. And I found the Corporation Commission was very receptive to my arguments, that not only, you know, did we have problems with these two wells whose permits I was protesting, but also that Harper and Sumner County, where the large majority of the fracking was being done in Kansas, really needed some overall protections. And I was quite astonished because the afternoon, my case was heard in the morning, the afternoon session that started with them putting out an order for massive cutbacks all over the counties, the two counties in question. And it made an enormous difference. It really did cut back on earthquakes. Let me take an aside here, too. Joe has talked about the death of the fracking industry, but the geography, the subterranean geology of the fracking deposits, the Mississippian formation in northern Oklahoma and southern Kansas, is much more sensitive, I think, to precipitating earthquakes than, say, the Bakken formation in North Dakota. So I think that, fortunately for Kansas and Oklahoma, they would be the first to have action taken against them and shut down. But I think that a much more, a less sensitive geology that's found in North Dakota would allow them to persist much longer than the most sensitive areas. I should say, too, that Mary Fallon is a terrible governor, much like Sam Brownback, and she has controlled the geological survey in Oklahoma and has some leverage over the Corporation Commission, which is elected in Oklahoma. And she has been determined not to do anything to cut back on fracking there, except what she says now is to study the issue, which means not do anything at all, of course. I wanted, too, to say, and I appreciate the caller who called in, part of the problems we have is illegal dumping. So it's not only the subsurface stuff, the injection wells that go down to the Arbuckle Range, which is considerably below the surface of the earth and far lower than the area, which is about 5 kilometers and 3 miles deep, that the frackers are extracting oil and brine from right now, but and that the deep injection wells are causing the earthquakes mostly, but the dumping on the surface is not unheard of. I mean, they've caught them in Texas dumping tanker loads of these fracking wastes, which is. The caller mentioned were radioactive and full of very, very toxic chemicals. They've dumped them right on the roadway when they can get away with it. So we're dealing with an industry that knows exactly what they're doing. They have seismic data that far exceeds anything that the Oklahoma or Kansas Geologic Surveys have at their disposal because they've, you know, they've gone over and over and over this with sophisticated equipment. And exploding charges to determine what the geology is, and they just don't care. They're dumping it because it's cheapest to dump it where it hurts the public the most. They have no consideration for the public whatsoever. It's just a feature of their recklessness.
Frank,
I wanted to say too.
Frank, yeah, we just have 1 minute left, and I think Joe wanted to make another comment too.
Well, and it's a partly just a tribute to Frank. I want to make sure people understand that a lot of the progress we made in Kansas with the Kansas Corporation Commission was due to Frank's activism. He's just been terrific and relentless in just seeking justice and action. And I want to give credit where credit was due. The Kansas Corporation Commission did pass the regulations that forced the oil and gas companies to reduce the use of the injection wells, that has reduced the number of earthquakes. It's not gone. We had 32 in January, and we're seeing the quakes move westward into counties westward. And so the KCC has expressed their interest in imposing the regulations on other counties too. And part of that is due to Frank's activism. So we all owe Frank a lot of thanks.
All right.
Well, it's due to my activism, but it's also due to receptivity. I think that the present composition of the KCC has for the public. I'm just amazed. It's kind of like Eisenhower appointing Earl Warren as the head of the Supreme Court. I think Brownback made a real mistake.
Frank, we need to turn it over to we need to move on. The Natural Lead needs to do the calendar, which is coming up next. I want to thank both Joe Spies and Frank Smith for being here, and stay tuned.
Thanks, Craig. This is Naturally. I have your local environmentally minded events hosted by the Kansas City Community Gardens. The Planning Your Plot for Garden Success workshop will share how to create a planning plan to help maximize garden space, get more vegetables, and save time and money. KCCG has developed some new tools to help you create a garden plan and shopping list for spring, summer, and fall. This free event will be held 6 p.m. on Tuesday, March 8th. At Ivanhoe Community Center, which is located at 3700 Woodland in Kansas City. Workshops are free, but space is limited, so RSVP by calling 816-931-3877 or visit our Facebook page. Also on March 8th from 7 to 9 p.m., at the Kansas Sierra Club's next general meeting, special guest Betsy Betros, a Kansas master naturalist, will present Pollinators, Feel the Love. Betros was the pollution control director for the Environmental Department of Johnson County, with responsibility over air quality, industrial waste water control, household hazardous waste collection, solid waste, hazardous material spill response, and pollution investigation. After 35 years with the county, she retired in 2013. But she's here hosting this event about pollinators on March 8th from 7 to 9 at the Overland Park Lutheran Church, which is located at 7810 West 79th Street over in Overland Park. You can visit kansas.sierraclub.org for more information. And finally, the Sierra Club Kansas chapter is hosting its biennial statewide conference with the topic, The Moral Imperative of the Climate Crisis. The event will include a special message from Michael Bruni, Sierra Club Executive Director Wyatt Townley, Kansas Poet Laureate from 2013 to 15, and a keynote address by author Donald Worster. This free event will be held 8:30 a.m. to 4:15 p.m. on Saturday, March 12th at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Topeka. Free lunch will be included. This event is open to members and the general public. Registration is required, so please visit kansas.sierraclub.org to find more information about this event.
Lead in school drinking fountains? That and other stories for the week ending March 6, 2016. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Schools across the U.S. are drawing concern due to lead found in drinking fountains and kitchen faucets.
Yana Lambrinadu, a faculty member at Virginia Tech University, says that schools are particularly vulnerable to aging pipes, faucets, and valves.
She told The Guardian that a slew of recent cases in which schools have turned off water due to lead may only be the tip of the iceberg.
Ever since the Flint water crisis was discovered, concern about lead poisoning has grown. Only about half of Americans say they're confident in what's what's flowing out of their taps, according to a recent poll.
In late February, the Binghamton, New York School District either shut down taps or installed filters due to lead detections.
In Healdsburg, California, lead has been detected in the water for a second time at a school. The drinking fountains were shut off, and food preparation was moved off-site.
In Jackson, Mississippi, schools are urgently moving ahead with testing after lead was uncovered during citywide sampling.
In the state of Washington, students and staff at one Bainbridge Island Elementary School were drinking bottled water last week after high levels of lead were found.
When asked what concerned parents should do, Lambrinidou said that she would organize other parents to request that their school sample the water and insist that lead-certified filters be used in any building constructed before 2014.
Last December 2015 was the hottest on record for global temperatures.
Then came January 2016, which was the planet's warmest month ever recorded.
And we learned last week that this past February was even hotter as measured by satellites.
Eric Holthaus of Slate reported that average temperatures across the Northern Hemisphere have breached the 2 degrees Celsius mark above normal.
He notes that it's likely the first time such a high level has been reached since human civilization began thousands of years ago.
And while the global temperature average may dip down below the 2-degree mark, Bill McKibben of 350.org points out that the Northern Hemisphere has not really had a winter.
Some of the temperature increase is due to El Nino, but one must consider that the current effects from the Pacific Ocean phenomenon come on top of already increasing global warming. 1 million people are at risk if something isn't done quickly to shore up the failing Mosul Dam in Iraq.
That warning of potential disaster was issued by the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad last week after years of neglect have left the structure at risk of catastrophic failure.
While the Iraqi government has downplayed the danger posed by the country's largest dam, it has advised many residents of the heavy populated Tigris River Valley to move at least 3.5 miles away from the riverbanks.
According to the BBC, the dam has been structurally flawed since it was built in 1984 because its base was made from gypsum, a mineral that is water-soluble. To counter the erosion, engineers have been drilling holes and filling them with a cement grout mixture around the clock.
That maintenance work was disrupted for 11 days in 2014 when Islamic State militants briefly seized the dam. Even after it was recaptured by U.S.-backed Iraqi forces, many workers didn't return to continue repairs, and efforts were slowed because the nearby factory that provided cement was controlled by ISIS.
Iraqi officials insist that the risk is small, telling The Guardian that although the spring snowmelt from Turkish mountains would raise water levels, the dam's reservoir was currently only about one-third full.
In an editorial, The Guardian states that much of the territory threatened by potential floodwaters is controlled by ISIS. But the biggest, most immediate threat facing Mosul residents could be renewed fighting to take back the city from the Islamic State.
That struggle raises the possibility that the dam could be destroyed even before it fails structurally, leaving residents in harm's way with nowhere to go.
Some are calling it the March miracle. Storms brought much-needed precipitation to California this weekend.
In Yuba County, north of Sacramento, major roads were shut down due to flooding, and thousands lost power as heavy winds came with the storm that ended a 14-day dry spell in Northern California.
Winds as high as 88 miles per hour were recorded on Mount Diablo, east of the Bay Area, and more rain is expected.
The forecast predicts that another system will move into the West Coast in the coming week, increasing rainfall totals and mountain snows once again. Up to 3 feet of snow could fall in the Sierra Nevada mountains.
And the storm was expected to dump several inches of rain in Southern California as well.
Some water officials said that a wet March will help ease the drought, but won't end it completely.
The director of the California Water Resources Department said in a statement last week that the Godzilla El Nino was not living up to predictions, and Californians needed to conserve as much as ever. And finally this week, water wars. No, not the dangerous ones that are predicted to happen from climate change-induced water scarcity. This battle may be on the shelves of your local Whole Foods market.
Introducing cactus water. It's the latest contender in the craze among the health-conscious to hydrate with benefits. You might be familiar with coconut water, the so-called kale of beverages that's been trendy for years, but cactus water is ready to break into the marketplace.
Yes, we too wondered how the latest boosted water trend could come from an arid hot region, but the cactus drink actually comes from the fruit of the prickly pear cactus, and its proponents say it's loaded with antioxidants, vitamins, and minerals, and has anti-inflammatory properties.
Its manufacturer claims that cactus water is not only the perfect post-workout recovery drink, but it's better than coconut water because it contains a nutrient that can fight pimples and reduce under-eye puffiness.
If this sounds too good to be true, there's even more to this miracle drink. It's purported to prevent hangovers.
Anything with electrolytes will regulate hydration, the key to curing your morning after headache, but backers are hoping cactus water will be the drink you grab before your wild night out.
But fair warning, cactus water is expensive, putting you in a prickly situation if you're hungover and on a budget. This Week in Water is sponsored by the American Water Works Association. Unite the world of water at AWWA's ACE 16 in Chicago, June 19th through 22nd. Learn more at awwa.org/ACE16.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.